This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, covering the Framingham and Metro West area. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, I will be bringing you news from the Sunday, July 26th edition of the Metro West Daily News. This is Craig Fife reading to you live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. And as always, we will begin with the obituaries in the Sunday edition. Stephen Amston Fitz, 87, passed away peacefully on July 22nd, surrounded by the love of his family. Family and friends are invited to honor and remember Stephen's life by gathering for visiting hours in the Norton, McKinney, and Lawler Funeral Home, 53 Beach Street, Framingham, on Wednesday afternoon, July 29th, from 4 to 7 p.m. His funeral services will be celebrated in Cushing Memorial Chapel, 60 Dudley Road, Framingham, on Thursday morning at 10 o'clock. Interment will follow in Edgell Grove Cemetery, Framingham. In lieu of flowers, you can honor Stephen's memory by donating to Metro West Home Care and Hospice, 200 Nickerson Road, Suite 110, Marlborough, Massachusetts, 01752, or by donating online at https://www.amedisys.com/services/hospice-care/donations and use hospice location 058-MA-Marlborough. To share a memory with the Fitz family, kindly visit www.nortonfuneralhome.com. That's NortonFuneralHome. Nancy Eisen Winter Wilson, age 87, passed away peacefully on Saturday, July 11th, at Newton Wellesley Hospital. Donations may be made in Nancy's memory to the Alzheimer's Association in support of caregivers, 480 Pleasant Street, Watertown, 02472, or at alz.org. A memorial service will be held at St. Paul's Episcopal Church, 39 East Central Street, Natick, on Saturday, August 1st at 10 a.m. Burial will be private. For online guestbook, please visit www.everettfuneral.com. That's EVERETTFUNERAL. Reverend Charles A. Gaines passed away peacefully at home on Saturday, July 4th, with his wife Carolyn and daughter Susan by his side. A memorial service will be held at the First Parish in Framingham in October. Gifts in his memory may be sent to the Charles and Carolyn Gaines Memorial Intern Minister Fund, First Parish in Framingham, 24 Vernon Street, Framingham, Massachusetts, 01701, or the Memorial Fund, Unitarian Universalist Church, 4831 East 22nd Street, Tucson, Arizona, 85711. Robert A. Bob Perkins, 83, of Upton, passed away unexpectedly on Saturday, July 19th, while traveling to Maine with his family for their cherished annual vacation. Calling hours will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, July 29th, at the Pickering & Son Upton Funeral Home, 45 Main Street, Upton. His funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, July 30th, at the United Parish of Upton Church, 1 Church Street, Upton. Burial with military honors will follow at Lakeview Cemetery in Upton. For his complete online tribute, please visit www.uptonfunerals.com. And those are the obituaries from the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News. And now some local news. Massachusetts House advances animal welfare bill. Senate pet shop ban dropped. This story is by Margie Cullen, USA Today Network, New England. The Massachusetts House passed an animal welfare bill on July 15th that addresses animal neglect and helps service animals ride Ubers, but does not include a pet shop ban that the Senate had championed. In March, the Senate passed its version of the Pets Act, which includes a ban on the sale of cats and dogs at pet shops. Senators celebrated the bill, saying it would end the inhumane puppy mill to pet store pipeline. However, opponents said the legislation would not stop people from purchasing dogs from puppy mills and would instead punish responsible pet stores that do not work with puppy mills. An amendment from State Representative Natalie Higgins, Democrat Lemonster, to include the ban on the sale of dogs, cats, and rabbits in new pet shops was withdrawn on July 15th, and the final bill does not include the pet shop ban. House spokespeople did not immediately return a request for comment on why it was dropped, but they told State House News Service on July 15th that the House decided to focus on other areas. The two chambers will have to come to a compromise before the bill can go to the governor's desk. The bill passed 151-1, with State Representative John Gaskey, Republican Carver, as the only member in opposition. The House's version of the welfare bill creates a sweeping set of regulations that tackle neglect cases, pet ownership, veterinary care, and kennel laws, among other issues. If there is any issue that we can all agree on, it's that all of our furry friends deserve long, happy lives, State Representative Jack Patrick Lewis, Democrat Framingham, said in a statement. This legislation is a strong step toward that goal. We are employing robust measures to promote good caretaking and penalize bad actors, such as expanding policy related to veterinary technicians and pet insurance, banning the use of animals in households, household product safety research, and adding new oversight to the kennel industry. Here are some of the measures included in the bill. Some are the same as the Senate-passed bill, while others were added by the House. Establishes a legal process for processing cases of animal neglect, such as allowing an animal control officer to remove a pet from its owner if the owner fails to provide adequate food, water, shelter, or veterinary care. Strengthens oversight and reporting on dog kennels, including allowing for the revocation of license if the kennel is not being maintained in a humane manner. directs the Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities to create a pet ownership program for residents of public housing, including a limit on pet deposits and prohibition on discriminating based on a pet's breed, size, weight, or appearance. Prohibits manufacturers from testing cosmetic or household products on animals if there are alternative test methods. Requires rideshare companies to include a feature on their app that tells the driver that the rider will have a service animal. Offenders would face a $500 fine for a first offense. Creates licensing standards for veterinary technicians. Closed pizzeria has new owner. This story is by Carolyn Bunnell, Metro West Daily News, USA Today Network. A downtown pizzeria that closed this month after its owner candidly stated on social media that the business has been experiencing a monthly loss of $7,000 to $10,000 for the last few months is under new leadership and is expected to reopen soon as sometime in August. Eric Salgado, previous owner of Nick's Pizza and Grill at 87 Main Street, told the Daily News that he decided to sell after 2 years of ownership, citing a difficult economy and tepid customer spending. The storefront has housed a pizza shop since the 1980s. Salgado said the restaurant officially closed on July 17th, but has been transferred to a new owner, whom he said in a Facebook post expects to reopen sometime next month. He said the new owner has experience working in several pizza shops and is now looking forward to operating his own. Salgado said running Nick's over the past 2 years was challenging because of rising costs and other economic pressures. Prior to 2025, there were still five pizza shops and everybody was able to survive, he said. As the economy turned and got worse, that's where it no longer became everybody surviving. Ashland is home to several other pizza shops, including Killa Pizza, New York Pizza, Ashland Pizza Palace, and Townhouse Pizza and Roast Beef. When Nick's opened under Salgado in 2024, he said he soon encountered unexpected expenses, such as equipment repairs. By the following year, he began noticing changes in customer behavior, and that led to further financial difficulties. The past 2 to 3 months, we were about $7,000 to $10,000 below our baseline overhead costs, so payroll, costs of goods, electricity, and everything else, he said. Salgado said he invested additional money into the business, but it was quickly consumed by operating expenses. By earlier this year, he said he realized the trend was unsustainable. He also observed shifts in spending habits among local residents. Salgado said he noticed some immigrant families stopped visiting because they feared leaving their homes. Meanwhile, many middle-income residents appeared to be cutting their spending and were increasingly choosing not to dine out. At the same time, Salgado thinks many of Ashland's wealthier residents are spending money in neighboring communities. He said Ashland is working to create a more active downtown, but that effort is still developing. The way I've assumed that it really played out is Ashland has a fairly wealthy population, he said. They're not going out of town. They're going to Natick or Holliston or wherever and not spending money in town. But Beth Reynolds, Ashland's assistant town manager for community development and community affairs, told the Daily News that she has not seen any data indicating that residents are traveling to other communities to dine. While several restaurants have closed in recent years for a variety of reasons, she also said others have quickly changed owners and reopened, such as Killa Pizza and New York Pizza. Reynolds said the town is working to revitalize downtown Ashland and the Route 126 and Route 135 corridors through improvements such as a new streetscape, and efforts to create a more walkable destination. Ashland is a great place to have your business, in my opinion, she said. I feel like we're a very business-friendly community, and I feel like the businesses that come to town feel supported by our team here. The rising food costs also put pressure on Nick's Pizza, Salgado said. A case of tomatoes that once cost $19 now costs around $80, he said, attributing those increases to seasonal factors and broader economic conditions. While he said Nick's raised prices slightly, Salgado said he was reluctant to pass all of the cost increases on to customers. To offset rising expenses, the restaurant tried several strategies. Salgado streamlined its menu, offering $8 large pizza promotions, invested in social media advertising, and hosted events geared toward middle and high school students, including karaoke nights and improv performances. While some efforts gained interest, Salgado said none generated significant or lasting boosts. It's really getting that buy-in from customers that we weren't getting, he said. Reynolds pointed out that small brick-and-mortar businesses can face challenges in any community and often need more support than large companies that have more resources. Salgado emphasized the importance of supporting small businesses if residents want them to remain open. A lot of it comes down to economic fear that's going around, he said. If you want small businesses in your town, you have to support them, and not just on special occasions. And now let's pause for a short break.
Audio Journal, the radio reading service of Central Massachusetts, serving visually and print-impaired listeners since 1987. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
The Worcester Public Library announced the opening of an interactive tactile exhibit at its main branch at 3 Salem Square from July 15th through August 15th. Created by Tactile Images, the exhibit uses patented technology that transforms iconic works of art into three-dimensional tactile renderings, allowing visitors to experience visual information through touch. The exhibit's design, in part, makes visual art more accessible to the blind or visually impaired. The exhibit, Seven Arts Movements, examines the evolution of history's art movements through tactile reproductions of works by renowned artists including Leonardo da Vinci, Johannes Vermeer, and Vincent van Gogh. It also explores stylistic characteristics of the Renaissance, Baroque, Neoclassicism, Impressionism, Post-Impressionism, Art Nouveau, and Expressionism. The exhibition features seven tactile images, each paired with corresponding fine art print. And you're listening to the Metro West Daily News Sunday edition, where the time now is approximately 18 minutes past the hour. 9 questions officially qualify for the Massachusetts ballot. This story is by Margie Cullen, USA Today Network, New England. Massachusetts voters will see 9 questions on their ballot this November, the Secretary of Commonwealth William Galvin's office announced July 21st. The list was official after a challenge to a question to repeal legal marijuana sales failed. Other questions include ones to allow same-day voter registration, to expand the state's public record law, and to establish all-party primaries. First Deputy Secretary Michelle Tassinari, Director of the Elections Division, assigned the order of the ballot questions, according to Galvin's office, which said in a press release the questions were ordered in a manner intended to maximize space on the ballot, with the length of the question summaries being the primary consideration. With so many questions, ballots in most communities are expected to be 2 or 3 pages long, the press release continued. The length of each community's ballot will depend on the number of offices and candidates running in that community, whether the ballot must be printed in more than one language, and any local questions that may be added to the ballot by the city or town. Here's the order of the questions and a brief summary. Question 1, expanding the public records law. This proposal, backed by Massachusetts Auditor Diana DiZoglio, would make most records held by the governor's office and legislature subject to the state's public records law. Question 2, collective bargaining for CPCS employees. This proposal would allow employees of the Committee for Public Counsel Services to form a union. Question 3, state primary elections. This proposal would make Massachusetts state elections, starting in 2028, like Boston's. Candidates of all parties would be on a single ballot in the primary, with the top 2 finishers advancing to the general elections. These are sometimes known as jungle primaries. Question 4, excuse me. Question 4, election day registration. This question, proposed by Galvin, would allow Massachusetts voters to register at the polls on election day, also known as same-day voter registration. Question 5, state revenue limit and rebate. Business groups are pushing this question that would make the state revenue surplus cap law account for money from the millionaire's surtax. Question 6, Natural Resource Conservation Fund. This proposed law would establish a Nature for All fund that would receive 50% of state taxes from sporting goods, recreational vehicles, and golf courses. The money would be used for natural resource conservation, such as protecting green spaces and bodies of water. Question 7, single-family homes. Pushed as an initiative to make more affordable starter homes, this law would allow single-family homes to be built on lots as small as 5,000 square feet, provided they have at least a little room between the road. Question 8. Prohibit retail sale of adult recreational use marijuana. While Massachusetts has increasingly legalized marijuana in recent years, this question would repeal provisions of the current law that allow for the drug to be sold commercially in the state. And finally, question 9, firearms regulation. This is a referendum question on the 2024 gun reform law, known as Chapter 135, that strengthened Massachusetts gun regulations. A yes vote would uphold the law, while a no vote would repeal it. Westboro High Principal Leaving. This story is by Jesse Collings, Worcester Telegram and Gazette, USA Today Network. Longtime Westboro High School Principal Brian Callahan has taken a new position in Shrewsbury as he will leave the school he has led since 2013. Callahan was chosen on July 8th as the new Assistant Superintendent for Well-Being and Community Systems for Shrewsbury Public Schools. In his new position, Callahan will be part of a team overseeing programs involving student performance, mental health, and working with families to improve student outcomes and experiences in Shrewsbury Public Schools. Shrewsbury Superintendent Tiffany Ostrander, who took over the position earlier this month from Joe Sawyer, who retired after 17 years as superintendent, said during the July 8th meeting that in order to find the best candidate for the position, a search group put together a portrait of an ideal candidate, which Callahan fit. This individual needed to be supportive and student-centered, have strong communication and collaboration, is innovative and provides opportunities for continuous improvement, is data-informed and is a strategic leader, and has already established community partnerships, Ostrander said. Mr. Callahan consistently distinguished himself across these dimensions, and as the process progressed, it became increasingly clear that his leadership experience and approach closely aligned with what our leadership committee identified as essential. Callahan has spent the last 14 years as principal at Westboro High. Previously, he worked as an athletic director and assistant principal for Westboro Public Schools, and previously worked as a history teacher in West Boylston Public Schools. Ostrander said throughout his career, Callahan has demonstrated the skills needed to succeed in the position at Shrewsbury. Mr. Callahan brings 30 years of educational experience, including 14 years as principal at Westboro High School, following previous service as assistant principal, athletic director, and teacher, Ostrander said. This role requires someone that can lead and develop complex systems while never losing sight of individual students and families. Brian brings extensive secondary education experience in supporting student well-being. Callahan told the TNG that the position in Shrewsbury fit the kind of role he wants to have in shaping education through meeting student needs. Throughout my career, I've been passionate about the holistic approach to students, focused on being on well-being and developing them as learners and people, Callahan said. Students can't learn until they're safe. That means being safe physically, mentally, and emotionally. I got into this work because of students, to put them at the center of everything. During the meeting of the Shrewsbury School Committee on July 8th, Committee Chair Rachel Sharifipour said that Callahan was the perfect candidate to fit the position after interviewing him. I was very, very much confident that we did find that unicorn that we were a little concerned that we wouldn't be able to, Sharifipour said. He stood out in that interview process and such a way about him that exuded confidence. He had so many ideas, not just from the last few years, but from his entire time, and he was very impressive. Callahan said that during his time in education, he has done literally everything, from teaching to driving school buses to serving lunches and serving as principal for the past 14 years. He said it was a difficult decision to leave Westboro and that he will miss the people in the school when he departs. The energy that you felt every day from the students and people who work here, it will continue after I'm no longer here, but I will miss it, Callahan said. Our central office is in the middle of the school on the second floor, and you see everything. I won't see quite as many faces every day, so things will look a little different. Jack Foley, who recently retired as Gibbons Middle School principal in Westboro, will take over for Callahan as Westboro High principal on an interim basis, but only for the first semester of the 2026-27 school year. Following Foley, assistant principal Kate Mercadante, who will be returning from paternity leave, will take over alongside current assistant principal Jessica Barrett, who will serve as interim co-principals. A permanent replacement for Callahan will be selected following a search next year. Callahan is expected to officially start with Shrewsbury Public Schools on Monday, July 27th, which was yesterday. Nineteen candidates vying to be area police chief. This story is by Norman Miller, Metro West Daily News, USA Today Network. Hopkinton had 20 people apply to become its next police chief, according to Select Board member Matt Kisner. Kisner, a member of the town's police chief screening committee, provided an update on Tuesday, July 21st, during a select board meeting on the progress to find somebody to replace Joseph Bennett, who retired on June 30th. Scott Van Relten is serving as interim police chief. Kisner said 20 people originally applied for the job, but one has since dropped out, leaving 19. He said the screening committee has reviewed 10 resumes, with the other 9 to be reviewed July 23rd. After reviewing all 19 resumes, the candidates whom the screening committee believes are the most qualified will be moved to the next round, Kisner said. He said they hope to move 8 to 13 of them forward. "We're nowhere near saying a person is a preferred candidate to be police chief of Hopkinton," Kisner said. "The next step will be written and oral tests. From there, a to-be-determined number of top candidates would be moved to an assessment center, likely in August or early September, to narrow the list down to finalists interviewed by the select board." Bennett served 6 years as chief and 33 overall as a Hopkinton police officer. And now we'll take a short break. The Worcester Talking Book Library is committed to ensuring that everyone has access to education and cultural experiences, said Lee Ann Hooley, head of WTBL. This exhibit offers a unique opportunity for individuals who are blind or visually impaired to engage with art in a meaningful way, while helping sighted visitors gain deeper appreciation for accessible design and inclusive programming. Again, this is the Worcester Public Library announcing the opening of an interactive tactile exhibit at its main branch at 3 Salem Square from July 15th through August 15th.
The following is a public service announcement from the Worcester, Massachusetts Association for the Blind Support Group. Though vision and blind persons in the Worcester area are fortunate to have a support group sponsored by the Massachusetts Association for the Blind in Worcester, the group meets monthly at the Worcester Senior Center. The group provides information and resources to assist with daily living, assistive technology, transportation, and friendship. For more information, please call Marion at 508-754-0672. Again, that's Marion at 508-754-0672.
You're listening to the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News, where the time now is approximately 33 minutes past the hour. Why Marion Ryan says she should be reelected. This story is by Norman Miller, the Metro West Daily News, USA Today Network. Marion Ryan has been Middlesex District Attorney for 13 years. And in nearly every one of them, she says Middlesex County has been recognized by numerous groups as being among the safest in the United States. "That's the core job of the district attorney's office, keeping people safe," Ryan said. "It's our core mission." Ryan, 71, is seeking her fourth four-year term. She was appointed to finish Gerard Leone's term after he resigned in 2013 to join Nixon Peabody. She is facing former Middlesex Assistant Attorney David Solet in the September 1st Democratic primary. That's likely to decide the race, as there are no Republicans running. Ryan said that due to their proven track record for safety, she and her office can do things to help prevent crimes before they happen. When you're not dealing with a tsunami coming through the door every day. It allows us to do other things, she said. Those include creation of a cold case unit, a conviction integrity unit, a develop team that works to develop young prosecutors, and to invest in technology such as forensic DNA genealogy, which has been used to solve several crimes. Ryan said the office is also looking into AI, not just how to use it, but how it can be appropriately used for children and others. As district attorney, Ryan has made it a priority to work with legislators to strengthen existing laws and create new ones where there may be loopholes. She said she frequently testifies at state house hearings and typically helps get about 20 pieces of legislation passed each year. One of those included a loophole in a law that said medical professionals who sexually assaulted a patient after the patient gave permission to be touched could not be changed, even if it far exceeded what the exam intended. We had people who would go to a medical professional, get treated, realized they were assaulted, and come to us for help, and we couldn't, Ryan said. Along with State Senator Bruce Tarr, Republican Gloucester, and State Representative Kate Hogan, Democrat from Stowe, we worked on it and we finally got it passed so we can now charge them. Ryan said she has also worked on a hate crime bill that had a loophole regarding tenants or college dorm residents, as well as a bill to strengthen protections for medical professionals. Ryan said that unlike when she was first elected, she and other public officials must now stand up for the protection of the rule of law due to the Trump administration. She said immigration has been running over people's rights, something she battled back in 2018 when she obtained an injunction to prevent ICE from entering courts to arrest people. She obtained that injunction after ICE, in the middle of a trial, came into a courtroom and arrested a defendant, ending the trial. Everyone has to be vocal about this, Ryan said. It's important for every public official to stand up to some of the things this administration is doing. Ryan said she also provides experience both as head of the office and as a prosecutor, as well as a perspective few other district attorneys have, as a woman and a victim of a violent crime. In 1980, two men attempted to pull Ryan from her car in Cambridge. Her boyfriend fought them and was shot and killed. I'm the only woman who is serving as a district attorney in Massachusetts, she said. Having a woman's voice at the table matters. There are 11 of us, and I'm the only woman. I've had the experience of being a victim of a violent gun crime. We have a very victim-focused office. Representation matters. I have the endorsement of the Attorney General, Andrea Campbell. We have recognized how important it is. When I do our Empowering Girls events, I want them to see me doing this job. It shows them that they can do it. Why David Solette says he should be elected. The story is by Norman Miller, Metro West Daily News, USA Today Network. David Solette said the Middlesex District Attorney's Office needs a change. Solette, who spent most of his career as a prosecutor in the office, is seeking to unseat his former boss, Marion Ryan, in the September 1st Democratic primary, saying she has become complacent and timid after more than a decade in office. The winner of the primary will likely become the next district attorney, as no Republican is in the race. The current district attorney, she's been in charge for more than 10 years, Solette, 50, said. That's a long time. The current district attorney, in a lot of cases, has become too timid to act, too reluctant to lead. The job of a district attorney is to protect public safety and prosecute serious violent crimes. It's not all the district attorney's office does, but it's one of the most important things. Solette of Cambridge is a father of two and a graduate of Harvard University Law School. Along with serving as a major in the Justice Advocate General Corps in the U.S. Army Reserve, he joined the Middlesex District Attorney's Office in 2001. During this time, he served as a juvenile court prosecutor in Cambridge and a domestic violence prosecutor in Somerville. He also was a member of the Special Investigations Unit as an organized crime unit, as well as the first chief of the Cyber Protection Unit. He also served as chief legal counsel for the State Secretary on Public Safety from 2015 to 2019, before returning to the District Attorney's Office in 2019. In 2019, I went back to the Middlesex District Attorney's Office and founded the Cold Case Unit, Solette said. I had to basically build the unit from the ground up because it didn't exist before. Using new technology available, he said he started working on cases going back to the 1960s, not just murders, but sexual assaults. He said he helped solve more than a dozen older crimes, including 8 murders, as well as sexual assault involving a 17-year-old girl that happened in 1991. But when he returned to the office, he said he saw the district attorney's office was having problems. He said Ryan was worried as much about optics as prosecuting criminals. I want stronger penalties against repeat violent offenders, including drug traffickers, he said. We need to keep dangerous people off the streets with dangerousness hearings for offenders who are charged with sex crimes against children, making bombs, and cross burnings. Solette also wants to close legal loopholes that prevent prosecutors from asking for suspects to be held without bail as a danger to the public for aggravated rape, bomb making, and cross burning. Through the cold case unit, Solette said he helped identify a rape suspect, but the statute of limitations had expired. He said he urged Ryan to use the case as an example to ask the legislature to change the statute of limitations laws. He said she declined, only changing her mind after he announced he was running against her. A spokesman for Ryan's campaign replied via email that legislation regarding the statute of limitation for sexual assault was filed long before the case to which Solette is referring to came to light. Leadership is not about quibbling over who gets credit. It's about recognizing those who deserve it, said the spokesman, Scott Ferson, adding that the bill did not originate in the Middlesex DA's office. Solette resigned from the district attorney's office to run against Ryan. Solette said other important goals, if elected, include establishing a gun crime unit to go beyond the surface gun possession charges and to find where illegal guns are coming from, to strengthen drunk driving laws. I guess that's drugged driving laws. Work to strengthen laws on hate crimes, work toward fair pay for defense lawyers, and to help develop laws that better prevent seniors from being financially exploited. Solette has garnered many endorsements from the law enforcement sector. Police unions in Ashland, Framingham, and Marlboro are among them, as well as several statewide police organizations. This job isn't about politics. It's about getting justice and doing the right thing, he said. The people of Middlesex County deserve to know the district attorney's office is going to do the right thing, not just when people are watching, but when people aren't watching. Your district attorney shouldn't be afraid to use the laws already on the books and your district attorney shouldn't be afraid to ask the legislature to change the laws that are letting us down. When it comes to keeping people safe, the district attorney's office has to take the lead. And now let's take a short break.
Hi, my name's Owen Devlin, and this is my story. When my doctor told me I was losing my vision, I was devastated. I worried about my future. How would I attend college, find a great job, start a family, or even travel around my own neighborhood? Luckily, my doctor also told me about the Mass Commission for the Blind. They connected me and my family to a counselor who helped us to set a vision for my future. One that included assistive technology to allow me to go to school and find a meaningful job, a white cane to help me navigate, and even tips on how to use Google Maps on my mobile phone. I found out that losing my vision wasn't the end of the world.
If your loved one is blind or visually impaired, find out if they are eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
You're listening to the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News, where the time now is approximately 46 minutes past the hour. Bank assesses damage from Venezuela quakes. The story is by Andrea Shalal, Reuters. Two earthquakes that rocked Venezuela on June 24th caused $19.6 billion in direct physical damage, but the cost of rebuilding could be twice that much or more, the World Bank said in an early assessment released on July 23rd. The 7.2 and 7.5 magnitude quakes killed about 5,000 people, according to the government, destroying residential buildings, infrastructure, and non-residential buildings in the northern areas of the country, including the capital, Caracas. The government estimates that nearly 17,000 people were injured and nearly 18,000 remain homeless. The disaster, the country's deadliest earthquake since 1812, came at a time when socioeconomic conditions were already precarious, with a poverty rate of over 76%, the World Bank said. Some 7.9 million people have fled the country since 2015. The earthquake caused an estimated $19.6 billion in direct physical damage, a staggering figure for any economy and one that demands a coordinated response, said Susana Cordero Guerra, the World Bank vice president who oversees Latin America and the Caribbean. Without timely additional investment, the negative impact on productive capacity and living standards will slow the path to recovery, she said. The bank completed its Global Rapid Damage Estimate, or GRADE, using remote-based earthquake modeling, local seismic data, satellite imagery, and damage reports from government, humanitarian agencies, and others. The estimate does not include the cost of building back better through structural improvements or upgrading construction type. These costs, including debris clearance, could be 2 to 2.5 times the replacement costs, which could drive the total bill close to $50 billion. The estimate also does not include direct economic losses, with labor supply expected to be reduced by 1% this year. The bank said it was working with the Venezuelan government, the Inter-American Development Bank, and the Development Bank of Latin America, CAF, on a more comprehensive assessment of Venezuela's recovery and reconstruction costs. Such studies usually take months, while GRADE assessments are done in weeks. The assessment showed that 47% of the damage occurred in residential buildings, 27% in infrastructure, and 26% in non-residential buildings. The bank said that the pace of reconstruction would be a decisive factor in shaping the country's economic recovery and social outcomes. Without higher public and private investment, productive capacity and GDP would likely remain below pre-earthquake levels until at least 2036, the bank said. Additional borrowing would add to Venezuela's already large debt stock, but could stoke stronger growth, which could gradually strengthen the country's fiscal position, it said. War in the Middle East. Conflict spread to Red Sea, Caspian. But Gulf stays quiet as U.S. forgoes new strikes. This story is by Raphael Satter and Lefteris Papadimas, Reuters. Signs of the Iran war's spread emerged this weekend despite a pause in U.S. strikes as Yemen's Iran-aligned Houthis attacked Saudi oil installations along the Red Sea coast, and Iran accused Ukraine of targeting an Iranian vessel in the Caspian Sea. The U.S. military said on July 25th that its naval blockade against Iran remains in full effect, but did not explain why it halted a streak of 13 nights of escalating strikes. Asked about the pause, a senior official in President Donald Trump's administration said Trump has always been clear that his preference is diplomacy, but he has shown Iran what will happen if they fail to come to the table in a serious way. There were also no reports July 25th of attacks from Iran on neighboring countries, like those that have been taking place daily in response to the U.S. attacks. Despite the lull in the Gulf, fighting between Iran's Houthi allies and Saudi Arabia on July 25th indicated the war, which has already disrupted energy supplies through the Strait of Hormuz, could affect a second major shipping route and reignite Yemen's civil war. Separately, Iran's foreign ministry accused Ukraine of attacking an Iranian commercial vessel in the Caspian Sea, saying that it resulted in an explosion that killed a sailor and injured another. Earlier on July 25th, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, in a social media post, praised the results of long-range strikes in the Caspian Sea, alluding to vessels shipping military cargo, but did not identify the nationality of the targets. Yaha Sari said the group struck sites belonging to Saudi state oil company Aramco in Jizan and Yanbu. Video shared on social media and verified by Reuters showed a large column of smoke rising from the direction of the Aramco refinery in Jizan. Two Asia-based trading sources said they had been informed of potential damage to fuel and oil sites, storage sites in Jizan. Aramco did not respond to requests for comment. In Yanbu, two ballistic missiles aimed at oil installations were intercepted by a U.S.-made Patriot battery operated in Saudi Arabia by the Greek military under an agreement with Riyadh, Greek security sources said. Yanbu, Saudi Arabia's main Red Sea oil port, has become a key route for Saudi oil skirting the Strait of Hormuz, which Iran has blocked. Up to 400,000 barrels can be processed daily at the oil refinery in Jizan, a city on the Red Sea close to the Yemeni border. In Yemen, the Air Force of the Saudi-backed, internationally recognized government, which has opposed the Houthis for more than a decade, struck Houthi launch sites and arms depots in the Marib and Al-Jawf provinces, Yemeni officials said. Earlier, the Saudi-led military alliance said it bombed Houthi military positions on July 24th in the Red Sea port of Hodeidah. Yemeni officials said both sides in Yemen's civil war were mobilizing forces along the front. Saudi Arabia has led an Arab coalition battling the Houthis for more than a decade since the Iran-aligned fighters captured Yemen's capital, Sana'a. The Yemeni civil war, during which hundreds of thousands of people died from fighting and famine, has been paused under a ceasefire since 2022. But that truce broke down this month, with the Houthis effectively joining the wider war with their Iranian allies, have waged since the attack being attacked by the United States and Israel. The Houthis have declared a naval blockade of Saudi Arabia over the past week, and Houthi leader Abdul Malik al-Houthi said all of the Saudi oil facilities could be targets. On July 23rd, the Houthis struck two Saudi tankers in the Red Sea. American forces recently resumed their own blockade on Iranian ports. U.S. Central Command, whose coverage area includes the Middle East, said it disabled a ship whose crew attempted to run a blockade despite repeated warnings on July 24th in the Gulf of Oman. And that's about all the time we have for this broadcast. You have been listening to a reading of the Metro West Daily News for Sunday, July 26, 2026. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or Braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Craig Fife, and I thank you for listening.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
What's your vision?
My vision is 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye, zero vision in the left eye.
No, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, we believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
This is Bird Note. Zoos can be great places to see birds, and not just in an aviary. Next time you visit, keep an eye out for wild birds that choose to live in this urban green space. One frequent visitor at many zoos is the black-crowned night heron. At the St. Louis Zoo, there's often one hanging around the outdoor penguin exhibit, hoping to steal a stray fish from the penguin's food. Elsewhere, night herons are after more than a quick meal. Since the late 1800s, a large rookery of black-crowned night herons has nested at the Smithsonian's National Zoo in Washington, D.C. Chicago's Lincoln Park Zoo hosts hundreds of night herons. And at the Detroit Zoo, several dozen pairs take up their summer residence in trees near the crocodile exhibit. Night herons love nesting near bodies of water, where they can catch fish, frogs, and other prey. So a zoo that has a pond or two nearby turns out to be a perfect spot for a night heron rookery. Wildlife-friendly landscaping can create opportunities for species that struggle to find habitat elsewhere. For black-crowned night herons, a city zoo can be home sweet home. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
You are listening to Audio Journal.
part of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Thanks for listening. We have more programming coming up next.